Autumn Shadows in August, a novel by Robert W. Norris. Read by Robert W. Norris. Copyright 2006, Robert W. Norris. Let the journey begin, my head says, and I'm back in eighth grade when I meet Damian Riley. I've recently bought a table baseball game, Stratomatic, which advertises a statistical accuracy similar to the real major league players' performances if one plays the games and manages the teams over an entire season. I've started playing my first full season, the 1964 National League season, keeping all the pitching and hitting statistics, managing the teams, living in a dream world of baseball, neglecting my studies, keeping game-by-game accounts, and entertaining a desire to become a major league statistician. The games and statistics are my constant companions. Damian and I are introduced one day by a boy who knows we both have baseball table games. Damian's is the APBA game. He's convinced it's superior to Stratomatic. I invite him to my home. We play a Stratomatic game between the San Francisco Giants and Milwaukee Braves. Willie Mays, whom in real life I dislike because he's considered a better player than my hero, Hank Aaron, hits 5 home runs. I order the APBA game the next day. I've never met anyone like Damian before. There's nothing he can't do well. He has all the confidence I myself lack. He's a handsome boy who moves his 5-foot-8-inch frame with such ease, has such deep green eyes, and carries such a confident satisfaction with himself, his abilities, and the world around him, that it's impossible not to like him. His is a sarcastic humor that coincides with my own. For the first time in a long time, I've found someone in whose presence I feel completely at ease, someone who can make me burst out in belly laughs. This grin right now feels great, just great. Ah, those belly laughs. Someone who reciprocates with a mirth that has no bounds. Best of all, Damian, too, lives in a world of baseball dream and fantasies. Our friendship revolves around APBA. We're inseparable. We spend hundreds of hours together playing APBA. In all my life, I have known few joys comparable to the sessions we have at our APBA tables. In my room, there's a wooden table with a formica top, but Damian's table is much better. It's a large, circular glass table that seems made for the express purpose of playing our beloved game. We polish the glass in a pregame ritual. I touch the table in front of me, start making circles with my hand, peer into the patterns, circular patterns themselves, 100 little baseball fields in those patterns, as if we are groundskeepers preparing the infield for play. Set up the game boards, select the starting lineups and pitchers, place the player cards in correct order, write down the necessary information in the scorebooks, pick out the special APBA dice, one is a little larger than the other, to give a possible 36 number combinations that correspond with numbers on the player's cards, which in turn correspond with more numbers on the game boards, which have all the possible game situations on them, such as bases empty, runner on first, runners on first and second, second and third, bases loaded, as well as adjustments for strong, medium, or weak fielding teams and differently rated pitchers, and dice cups. Sharpen our pencils and place the current statistics at hand for vital information needed during the game to broadcast to our imaginary fans or for the managers, ourselves, to use for making decisions based on batting streaks, averages, pitchers, total innings pitched. The pitcher might be tired from recent overwork. Lefty-righty pitching and hitting percentages, you name it, we have it. Once the preparations are made, we sit opposite each other. The games begin, each of us announcing his own game, filling in the time between plays with commentary on the ball players, team standings, importance of the game to the pennant race, the weather, the pitcher's motions on the mound, the expression of the umpire on a close play, the distance of a line drive to the outfield, the merits of a particularly difficult play, whatever comes to mind. The glass table is perfect for the rolling of the dice. They bounce on that table for an agonizingly long time in a clickety, metallic rattle, metallic shiver up and down the spine that extends the drama of the moment before finally settling upon the fate of each player's turn at bat. When announcing my games, I always struggle during the flash and click of the dice to think of something beyond my singular pattern of And here comes the pitch. It's a ground ball to Wills at shortstop. He scoops it up and fires a strike to first. One down, and the next batter is... Damien, on the other hand, is a master at instinctively spitting out euphonic baseball expressions and metaphors. In the capsuled moment of the dice, a continuous stream of baseball drama spills from his mouth. That was a close play at first. Alston doesn't like the call, and here he comes out of the dugout. He's walking to first base like he's walking to his brother's funeral. The fans are on their feet. Now here comes DeRocher out of the other dugout. He's racing across the field. Both managers are screaming at Donatelli. Donatelli looks as if he's caught between bookends. Yeah, we've got a real Donnybrook here today, folks. Then Damien twists his mouth to the side, lets out a roar simulating the unified voice of the fans' disapproval. I'm doing the same thing now. Breath exhaling long and slow, filling face muscles scrunch up. Scoops up the dice with his thumb into the cup, which he holds in the other four fingers of his right hand, and continues with the next play. At times I become so absorbed in Damien's game I completely forget about my own. I can almost smell the infield grass, feel the sunshine on my face, hear the cry of beer and peanut vendors in the crowd, and see the nervous movements of the players between pitches and the cloud of dust rising from a runner's slide into second. We are thoroughly devoted to APBA and to each other. We develop a special APBA song. A, Z, L, and X, and Y, and D, Z. We're just two APBA devotees. And our own secret language so we can talk about the game in classes, at school, at the hamburger shops, at the park, wherever we go, and not risk the ridicule of others who don't understand our obsession. We have our own APBA attaché cases inside which we've fastidiously placed the game contents in designated spots. The team packets containing the player cards in the back flap. The schedules, batting average books, so we don't always have to compute our statistics on paper or in our heads. Pens, pencils, and rulers in the front pocket of the back flap. And the game boards, notebooks filled with all the player's statistics, scorebooks, dice, and dice cups on the bottom. We plaster team decals on the outside of the attaché cases to show the world we're not scholars but serious APBA enthusiasts. We spend hours at a time on the telephone complaining to each other about the boredom of a Mets-Astros 2-week expansion team's game, comparing our leaders in all the statistical categories, describing in detail the excitement of a game in which two pitching aces like Sandy Koufax and Juan Marichal have hooked up in a 1-0 thriller, reporting on game-winning rallies and our favorite players and how they're performing, and trading new baseball expressions and gossip picked out of baseball magazines and the sporting news. Later, during high school summers of working for our dads and saving some money, Damien and I begin taking trips to San Francisco. For quite a while, our minds have been filled with a romantic vision of the city, a vision stimulated by the magic of radio and the voices of our favorite sports announcers. We've often talked about the city as if it were a secret place imbued with mystery and adventure calling to us like a siren in the night. We're growing bored with the dull characters and slow pace of the small lumber towns of Humboldt County. We need something new, a breath of fresh air to inject some life into our mundane existence. We take our first trip by bus during my sophomore year to see a professional basketball game. San Francisco is an enormous playground, pulsating with excitement. On every street corner lies a wealth of characters to see, drama to watch, comedy to laugh at, dialogue to listen to, movement to be swayed by, a treasure chest of sounds, smells, and sights to devour. It's a rich tapestry of infinitely varied life. It flashes before us like a jewel, blazing brilliantly with a life so strangely and continuously interesting it's intolerable that we miss any of it. We walk the swarming streets drunk with innocence and joy. After our first visit, we are two addicts in need of larger and larger doses. The city beckons to us with an uncompromising lure. Over the next 3 years, every penny we earn working for our dads goes toward our trips. In the beginning, we take the Greyhound bus, but after Damien's parents buy him a new sports car, we take our pilgrimages in it instead. We check into downtown hotels under false names, usually the names of obscure baseball players, hole up in a room for 3 to 5 days playing marathon sessions of APBA, going out only for baseball games at Candlestick Park or wandering the nighttime streets, then check out of the hotel without paying by dropping our suitcases from the second floor to an alley and walking out the entrance nonchalantly as if going out for coffee. After the APBA sessions, when we prowl the streets, our breasts heave with an unbearable joy to be a part of the panorama that surrounds us. It's wonderful to be alive now, too, in this hotel room, and that feeling then and this feeling now are connected. I know they are. There are the sharp cries and strident voices of the shoeshine men and newsstand vendors. Our favorite is Smokey Joe, who sits on the corner of Powell and Geary Streets, a dwarf of a man with an oversized head. His eyes bulge out of their sockets, his short legs are bowed like those of a miniature cowboy, and a long, fat cigar protrudes from his thick lips as he says, "There you go, there you go, what do you want, what do you want? That'll be a quarter, young man, there you go." There are the street artists in a colorful array of costumes who play music, perform acrobatics and mime, and juggle bowling pins. There are the throngs of shoppers streaming in and out of clothing stores, department stores, shoe shops, hat shops, all the shops that line the downtown area. There are the cable cars filled to bursting with tourists clanging up and down the hilly streets. There are all the women dressed in the latest fashions who walk proudly and sensuously, their heads tossing about and hips swaying. There are the gaudy prostitutes filing up and down Eddy Street who call out to passers-by, "How about a date, honey?" There are the black pimps in pink, red, and purple costumes, just like those colors dancing in front of my eyelids now, who prowl softly through the shadows. There are the hollow-eyed winos in tattered clothes who hang out on Market Street. There are the street-corner food stands with their aroma of hamburgers and grease, the coffee shops with a wide selection of waffles and cakes, the sleazy theaters on Market Street where we can see double features any time of the day. There are the neon lights and billboards showing naked women on the Broadway Strip, the ringing sounds of Chinatown, the grandeur of the spacious ballrooms, bars, and restaurants of the Fairmont and Hilton hotels. There are the cheap and tottering rides of Playland before it's closed down. There's the Greyhound Bus Depot where we play pinball machines and watch homosexuals on the prowl. Everywhere we go, there's an abundance of characters. The world of Humboldt County is dull and moribund in comparison. At the center of our vision of the city stands Candlestick Park, the home of professional baseball, the site for the contests that have stimulated our young hearts for years, the stage for all we deem good in life. We always go to the stadium 2 hours before game time to watch batting and fielding practice. Everything about the place excites us, the cries of the vendors, the crack of bats meeting balls, the sounds of the scoreboard organist playing "Take Me Out to the Ball Game," the cheers and taunts of the crowd, the rhythmic dance of the players taking infield practice and whipping the ball around the horn, the pitchers running laps, the foul balls landing in the stands and the crowd scrambling for them, the public address announcer calling out the starting lineups, the days of warm sunshine and nights of fog rolling off the bay, the wind that swirls dust in many cyclones around the pitcher's mound and the base paths, the hot dogs and peanuts that always taste better simply because we're at the ballpark, the starting pitchers warming up on the sidelines and occasionally chatting with the fans, the uniforms the players wear, the score cards in which we keep notes of every nuance of the game, and the fans of every shape, size, and nationality. Here are the players we've read about, dreamed about, managed in our APBA games, the players whose exploits we've listened to on the radio in Damien's room: Willie Mays, Orlando Cepeda, Juan Marichal, Gaylord Perry, Sandy Koufax, Tommy Davis, Damien's favorite after he led the National League twice in batting and knocked in 153 runs in 1962, Willie Davis, Don Drysdale, Maury Wills, Hank Aaron, Jim Bunning, Willie Stargell, Roberto Clemente, and all the others of that glorious age of baseball. Here we witness the games that still burn in my memory. The time we see the Giants defeated by my Braves 17-3, and Tony Cloninger, the Braves pitcher, clubs 2 Grand Slam home runs. He also hits another that lands about 3 feet foul in the right field stands, and adds a sacrifice fly to drive in 9 runs. the time Gaylord Perry pitches a one-hitter, allowing only a scratch single up the middle by the Chicago Cub second baseman Glenn Beckert in the seventh inning, the time Jim Bunning out-duels Juan Marichal by hitting a home run in the tenth inning to win the game 5-4, the many home runs and shoestring catches by Willie Mays, the line drive home runs and singles by Willie McCovey, who hits the ball harder than anyone we've ever seen, the pitching duels between Koufax and Marichal, Drysdale and Perry, when the Dodgers and Giants play out their intense rivalry. Often after the games we go to the hotels where the teams stay in hopes of catching a glimpse of our heroes, snatching a few words of conversation or collecting an autograph. One time we follow two Dodger players, Wes Parker and Jeff Torborg, to a movie theater, sit behind them and mimic their every move, doing the same thing now, hunching my shoulders, rolling my head back, nudging old Damien next to me, shit-eating grin on my face. Another time we meet Bill Sudeikis, a Dodger rookie, in the hotel elevator, and he pinches my stomach and says, "Take care, kid," and I turn 10 shades of red. Another time we knock on the Pittsburgh Pirates announcer's room door, hoping to meet Bob Prince, the famed announcer, but instead meet his assistant, Nellie King, who takes us out to breakfast and invites us the next day into the stadium announcing booth so we can see how a game is actually broadcast. One time we see Vin Scully walking down the street, and Damien, in a state of great excitement, darts across the street yelling, "Vinny! Vinny! You're the greatest!" Scully's visibly startled, but still kind enough to give his number one fan an autograph. There is never a dull moment during these trips to the city. If the crowds at the ballpark and in the streets are not enough to entertain us, we entertain ourselves by dancing in the streets, running zigzag courses like football halfbacks eluding tacklers through the throngs of people in the downtown area, playing slow-motion games of mime baseball or football in the aisles of the movie theaters, biting people's shoulders and scampering off like madmen, always spur-of-the-moment madness to make each other laugh. If I do something particularly original and insane that strikes Damien a certain way, he hits the ground as if shot by a bullet, curls up like a fetus in a struggle to catch his breath until seemingly ready to explode, then lets loose with a long, piercing scream, his arms and legs suddenly extended as if electrocuted. Laughing out loud now myself, "Damn, Damien, you're too much, man, too much. I love that scream laugh." San Francisco becomes for us the gateway to the outside world. Although we live in a genuine paradise tucked away in the redwoods, impervious to the events of the 1960s, the Vietnam War, the civil rights movement, the political assassinations, the drugs and sexual revolutions of that generation, we're becoming dissatisfied. There's too much to life. The world's too big for us to be contained forever behind the redwood curtain. Innocence will not last forever, but while it does, it's splendid. While the world remains a dream, and we create our own diversions, life is one continuous joyride, a marathon APBA game played in a San Francisco hotel room. A car horn from below reverberated through the hotel room and broke my train of thought. My focus fixed on the Picasso clown in his checkered outfit, which I now realized was a chessboard on which several pieces were moving about. Pablo's trick? I rubbed my eyes and craned my neck to get a better focus. I'll be damned if that isn't Damien and me, or at least one of my many me's, a different me from long ago, but part of me nonetheless. I'll call him David the Innocent, that's what I'll do. Oh, Innocent, what happened to you? Where did you go? I took a drink of beer, set the can back on the table, and closed my eyes. The mushroom journey shifted into high gear and catapulted me to the time just after the court-martial. Oh, what a lonely feeling it is to be put behind bars, the sound of the cell door slamming behind me, which is so real in my head that I nearly jump out of the chair, heart pounding, body shivering. As I'm placed in solitary confinement for the first 2 days because I'm supposed to be separated from the other prisoners until I'm given a medical checkup to make sure I have no communicable diseases. Those first 2 days of pacing the floor of the 8-foot-long, 4-foot-wide cell with its walls of concrete. Walls of concrete, walls of concrete, and man, the walls right now are breathing, moving, closing in on me. Yes, they are. Don't believe it, boy. It's the shrooms. It's the shrooms. It's solitary bed with one blanket. It's toilet with no seat. It's one window looking out upon the desolate landscape. Then, after the checkup, being allowed to join the other prisoners in a separate ward consisting of 2 cells, each with 6 beds and 6 lockers, a recreation room with a bookshelf containing Western and romance novels, a ping-pong table, and a TV we can watch for 2 hours in the evenings. Yeah, there are 4 other prisoners. Steve, the 21-year-old guy from Los Angeles who's in jail for 30 days for punching his commanding officer over some petty regulation he broke. Jerome, the 20-year-old black from Chicago who went AWOL for 6 months and is waiting for his trial. John, the Texan who was busted for drunk driving on base and is serving a 20-day sentence. Bob, the New Yorker who was also AWOL for a month. And for all of us, the days pass slowly, the routine being to get up at 6 in the morning, clean the jail, go to breakfast at the chow hall with an armed guard, return to the jail to wait for our daily assignments of going to various spots around the base to perform menial chores like scrubbing toilets, digging ditches, stripping and waxing and buffing office floors, all kinds of general cleaning duties. It's not such a bad existence, and sometimes I even run into David or Robert, my 2 buddies who are involved in running an underground anti-war paper, and they talk to me about the progress of the paper and turn me on to a few joints I can easily smuggle back into the jail, as the guards don't frisk me when I come back to the jail in the evenings, and the nights are fairly relaxed. Go to the chow hall again with one of the guards, return to the jail for a couple hours of ping-pong, then get locked up in our cells at 9 o'clock when the lights are turned off. Sundays we just lounge around the jail, sometimes get a visitor. The only visitor I get is David, and there he is that one Sunday handing me 4 tabs of mescaline, and after he leaves I give one to Hank, the huge black guy who just entered the jail a couple of days before, and it doesn't take long for us to become friends because we're both big revolutionaries, I the conscientious objector, Hank the big black panther. There we are at the back of the jail, eating our tabs, spending the rest of the day talking, giggling, discussing revolution, watching the jail pulsate and change colors, just like the room is pulsating now in cool colors, around me moving, waving, shimmering, and damn, I'm cold. And now he's telling me he's joined the Air Force to get trained in the use of sophisticated weapons so he can later train other Black Panthers in guerrilla warfare in preparation for the violent revolution that's coming between whites and blacks across the nation. And pretty soon, with tears streaming down his cheeks and a mescaline-induced display of emotions, he says, "You a good man, David, and I have nothing but good feelings towards you, man, but the day's gonna come when we gonna have to blow all you motherfucking white boys away, even you see, 'cause it's the only way we blacks will ever achieve total freedom from white control." Eyes blurring with tears, Hank's face right in front of me. And Hank kind of scares me with this talk and all the propaganda newspapers he shows me that have been smuggled into him. But at the same time, I feel excited in the same way I felt before in David and Robert's room when we talked revolution talk and I learned about Gandhi, Thoreau, Tolstoy, Marx, and others. But Hank's language is different from theirs, and he talks about other men like Malcolm X and Eldridge Cleaver and Bobby Seale, and in my heart I feel the black revolution is futile, but still Hank's sincerity touches me, and I feel I've traveled 1,000 light-years from my days of APBA and San Francisco baseball games and my old Redwood home. Hank and I are now friends. Every night we're smoking the pot I smuggle in, the pot given me by David or Robert when I happen to meet them during the hours spent doing details around the base in the daytime. Fumble with the joint, manage to light it, take 2 hits, put it down on the table, gaze for a second at the trails of movement my hand makes. And pretty soon, 2 of the other prisoners begin to join Hank and me during the 2 hours of free time every night. It's like a big party getting stoned and all, and there we are in the back cell blowing the smoke through the barred window, which has a lever to open the glass to allow in fresh air, one of us standing guard in front to make sure we aren't detected. The prison experience is becoming more pleasant, or at least more tolerable, and then it happens. The fire alarm goes off one night, and all 6 of us prisoners are hustled outside in what we are told is a fire drill. We stay outside for about 15 minutes, then are led back inside, and the first thing I notice is the film capsule we've stored the pot in is sitting on a window ledge in the back cell. We completely forgot about it during the previous night's smoking session, so I pick it up and hand it to Hank, who stashes it in his locker. And a minute later I notice blue ink all over my hands, so I go to the wash basin to try to wash it off, and I look over at Hank, and he's got the stuff all over his hands too, and then, in a flash, the prison doors open and about 10 guards, Central Intelligence Division agents, and the prison warden rush inside shouting orders. Everyone freezes. freezes, froze, frozen, helplessly frozen in mushroom space-time. Hank, you okay? Can't get you out of my mind. And Hank and I are separated from the others. The guards spread-eagle Hank against the wall and frisk him, and he's screaming, "You motherfuckers!" And one of the guards cracks him over the head with the butt of an M16, and Hank slumps to the floor and is dragged into one of the solitary confinement cells. One of the guards shouts at me, "Boy, if you don't keep quiet, I'll bash your head in, too." Then I'm spread-eagled against the wall, and another of the guards searches the lockers and finds the capsule of pot, and I'm thrown into another confinement cell next to Hank's, and through the walls I hear him singing, "Freedom, freedom, freedom, freedom. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child, a long, long, long way from my home, yeah, 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 yeah." And he keeps it up far into the night. There we are, Hank and I, the two big revolutionaries stuck in solitary for 2 days, and the guards are checking on us every hour on the hour to make sure we haven't done anything drastic like committing suicide. Our meals are brought to us twice a day on trays that are placed on the floor just inside the cell door, and now Hank isn't singing freedom songs so much but just scowling, I imagine, at the guards when they make their rounds. And twice a day we're taken out of the cells for interrogation sessions, but neither of us says a word other than we want to see our lawyer. And finally, on the second day, our lawyer shows up at the jail, and it takes him about 2 minutes to figure out that the guards and CID agents bungled their bust, because they didn't really catch us with any pot in our possession, and the blue ink we had on our hands is just circumstantial evidence. And he goes over to the window ledge where the pot was found and sprinkled with some kind of invisible fingerprinting powder. That, of course, was the stuff that turned blue on our hands. So the lawyer runs his finger across the window ledge and gets the same blue ink all over it, and proves to them that all Hank and I had to have done was accidentally touch the window ledge to get the stuff in our hands, and in so doing blows a hole in their case against us, which could have added another year or so to our sentences, and now the rumor spreads all over the base about the Keystone cops who busted their own prisoners inside their own jail and messed up the job so badly that they can't prosecute, and the story appears in the underground paper, and without our knowing it, Hank and I are suddenly Robin Hood type heroes, which makes the guards hate us even worse. I'm stuck in that solitary cell for the last 2 weeks of my stay at that base jail, and one day the guards come and take Hank away. Don't know where they take him or what happens to him. "Jesus, Hank, whatever happened to you? I just know it was too wretched to fathom in this miserable world. Oh, why are we all fated to suffer, and all the other prisoners too? What cosmic powers threw us all together, and how many of us escaped?" An icy breeze rushes through the room, shivering and bent over, head to my knees and eyes open. Sadness of life just weighs me down till I'm on the floor and into a fetal position, groan twice before breaking into spasmodic sobs, racked with a guilt I don't understand. That emotion passes, drag myself back into the chair, quivering hands, light another cigarette, inhale deeply, lean back in the chair once more, exhale slowly, try to get my emotional bearings, look around. Walls really are moving toward me this time, closing on me, just like the walls of that prison cell. Shift my gaze to stop the movement. Look once more at Picasso Clown. By Christ, that fucker, my alter ego, really? Moving around, dancing, giggling sardonically, pointing a mocking finger at me. "Hold on there, David boy. Get a hold of yourself. You're okay. Don't let the shrooms control you. You gotta control them." Nobody is talking to me anymore, and being separated from the other prisoners, I can't get any information anyway. So time passes in that little concrete cubicle, no contact with anyone until the day comes for me to gather up my few belongings, and they're shipping me by plane to Denver to complete my 6-month sentence at the 2230th Rehabilitation Group, where all the Air Force's nonviolent criminals are sent in the hope of rehabilitating them, retraining them in a different career field, and sending them back into service to complete the time remaining on their 4-year obligations. The thing that surprised me most, however, is that there's no guard accompanying me on the plane. Just spent 2 weeks in solitary, and suddenly I'm on a plane, and if I have the inclination, I can just up and split to Canada, or wherever, and be a free man. Well, maybe not so free, a kind of fugitive. But I decide not to do anything as rash as that, and so there I am being greeted at the Denver airport by an unarmed military policeman who drives me to Lowry Air Base, and it's almost like basic training again, the way we prisoners are herded into open bay barracks and given a strict daily regimen where we get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, all 100 of us placed in each barracks, and have 15 minutes to be shaved, showered, have our beds made and living areas spotlessly clean, and be down on the parade ground lined up in formation, ready to be marched a mile away to the chow hall for a breakfast of cold toast and runny eggs, We have to be done eating by 5:30, as that's when the regular soldiers on the base begin their breakfast. And of course, the brass don't want the regulars rubbing shoulders with the prisoners, nonviolent as we may be, just part of our punishment. Anyway, it's quite a madhouse to see 100 or so prisoners haggling and pushing and shoving over the 10 showers and 10 sinks in the latrine at the end of the hall, and someone's always getting knocked down and tension's in the air, but no way anyone can really fight, 'cause if they do, they'll get shipped out to Fort Leavenworth in Kansas for the remainder of their prison term, and from what we all hear, Leavenworth is worse than hell with its stories of brutal guards, hard labor, beatings, time spent in the hole. Nightmare images are all we hear about the place, and when we return from the chow hall, another hour is spent cleaning the barracks, and then there's the morning inspection, in which half the prisoners have to remake their beds, redust every corner of their living spaces, stand at attention for 2 hours waiting for the head guard to reinspect the premises. Then, for the first 2 months, we have to go to rehabilitation classes for 5 hours a day, and really, to me, they're more like brainwashing classes, because the military psychiatrists, chaplains, psychologists, doctors, instructors all have one common theme, that is, to show us prisoners that our way of thinking is wrong and bad and nonconformist, and that the only way to become human beings again is to follow the path they're providing for us, which in essence is to pound into our heads over and over again the fact that we've committed crimes against society and must change our way of thinking, our behavior, our very selves, if we ever want to become worthy citizens and re-enter the military and eventually society and carry on with lives of dignity and worth despite the terrible stigma of shame that is ours at the moment. They tell us they are in fact offering us a second chance, something that only a country as great as the United States would do for its citizens, something only a humane democracy would think of doing. And aren't we lucky to have this second chance? And if we blow this chance, then God help us, because great as our country is, we'll never be able to live a decent life if we don't allow ourselves to be rehabilitated. What's that sound? Laughter? From the psychiatrist? Picasso's clown mocking me? Feel deeply a shameful impotence, feel defeated, exhausted, heavy, helplessly frozen, imprisoned in space-time again, stripped of will and soul, just like those brainwashers wanted. Tell me who I am. Picasso, Vincent, Hank, anybody out there, just tell me who I am, who I was, please. Tears gushing, difficulty in swallowing, mouth dry, take another drink of beer, more trails of the hand. What the authorities say may be true for the other 500 or so prisoners who are at the 2230th for crimes ranging from drug abuse to theft to being AWOL for over a year, but I'm the lone prisoner of conscience, a political prisoner, so to speak, and all the therapy classes and private psychiatric sessions and role plays and discussions about morality and duty and obligation and correct thinking only serve to drive me deeper into myself, because I can see right away that the first step toward rehabilitation is for the prisoner to admit he was wrong to have committed this his particular crime. And all around me the prisoners are playing the game, showing their willingness to do what's expected of them. And there the professional brainwashers are, telling me over and over in their condescending, avuncular manner how screwed up I am and what a big mistake I made and how I'll come around sooner or later and see the light. But I've already come too far to admit having done anything wrong. It's almost as if I feel a perverted loyalty to my lawyer, David, Robert, Hank, the underground newspaper, and the movement, for Christ's sake. And most of all to myself, because if I give in now, then not only am I admitting I was wrong to the military, I'm also admitting weakness to family and others who doubt me, and burning deep inside of me is a stubbornness not to yield to any kind of renunciation by family or society. But still, I do have some doubts myself about what I'm doing, and these daily therapy sessions begin to put questions about everything in my head. The psychiatrists are too skilled at twisting my words and explanations of feelings around, and at showing me the contradictions of what I say, the lack of logic, the inconsistencies, and they seize on my inarticulateness and turn it against me, and many is the time I want to fall on my knees and beg them to stop, to leave me alone, so I just quit talking to them, start giving them the silent treatment. But this only inspires them to play further with my mind, to show me how insane I've become, and gradually, ever so gradually, I begin to believe them. Those assholes did come pretty close to breaking me, didn't they? Ribbon of light burst through the hotel room window as if a sign to lift me out of despairing, obsessing thoughts. Diamonds of dust sparkle in the air. Damn if the clown isn't now rolling a cup of APBA dice. Believe them until I stumble on the APBA idea. Thank you very much, God, for that beam of beautiful life-affirming light and that lift to my spirit. which comes at about the point where I just want to escape the constant invasion of my private world, and besides, they have me so tongue-tied and disoriented that I can't think straight, and as each day passes, they're coming closer and closer to breaking me down. I mean, I can put up with the physical confinement because it's not so bad, not much different from basic training, and I survived that once and figure I can survive it again, but it's just this constant wearing down of my mental state that I can't take, and I need some private place to retreat to where they can't reach, and it finally dawns on me, APBA, yeah, APBA, the same game and mental exercise I used in high school to retreat from teenage fears and apprehensions, and yeah, APBA once provided the perfect utopia for me, once captivated my every waking moment in such a blissful, innocent joy that the real world at one point almost ceased to exist. And why not? They're already convinced of my insanity to have done something so absurd as to defy every young man's duty to fight halfway around the world in a war to save democracy and crush the communist threat before it spreads to other countries in a domino effect until it reaches the shores of the United States, the greatest democracy of all. And certainly I've kept my APBA case with me all through my Air Force experience, occasionally bringing the game out to pass certain lonely hours in my barracks room back at my first base, but never with the same passion and intensity Damien and I played it way back in high school. But still, I've brought the game along with my other belongings to the 2230th Rehabilitation Group. So I take it out of my locker, and in the 2 hours free time we prisoners have every night, I begin spreading the game boards and notebooks out on the little desk I'm allowed for writing letters and such, and also take out the player cards of the 1967 National League season and the dice and dice cup, and now there I am rattling the dice, scooping them back into the dice cup, marking down in the notebook each player's turn at bat, doing the announcing in a low mumble, escaping the misery of this prison time, replaying the games in my head during the psychiatric sessions, answering the psychiatrist questions with answers pertaining to end-of-the-month batting averages, team standings, pitching leaders, and the psychiatrists just shake their heads and jot something down in their own notebooks. Pretty soon, some of the other prisoners, most of them black, start crowding around my desk in the evenings to relieve their own boredom and cheer for their favorite teams, and some of them start talking about me and calling me one gone dude. And because there are a lot of drugs being smuggled into the prison, it being minimum security and all, they start turning me on to a joint here, a pipe of hash there, and two or three times a hit of LSD. And yeah, there I am, high on acid, rattling the dice, listening to the cacophony of sounds surrounding me. And suddenly, the overwhelming humor of the situation hits me, and I break into a belly laugh I can't control, because everything seems so outlandishly hilarious. And I know I'll survive this prison experience, because you see, it's all one big joke, not a nightmare at all. And even in prison I'm able to make a few friends, because the clown in me hasn't died after all. Yeah, those old prison friends, maybe the best of the bunch is Slick the Black from Detroit, who's still officially in the rehabilitation program, even though he's served out his bad time because he hasn't fully rehabilitated. So in a sense, he's like a free man because he can leave the base sometimes and go into downtown Denver and meet the brothers on the streets and score some stuff and smuggle it back on base and pass it on to some of his buddies. I guess he trusts me, because I'm the only white guy who will play basketball on Sundays on the outdoor courts in the snow and cold, and yeah, old Slick's a great guy, one of the many Kerouacian Dharma bums I've met on many roads, and I'll never forget the times he brings me back a sandwich or something from the chow hall that week I'm laid up with a sprained ankle I've gotten coming down with a rebound on some guy's foot and can't march the mile in the snow to the chow hall. Getting back to my APBA strategy, I'm lucky the authorities start leaving me alone after I start playing the game. They must figure it's a waste of time to try to rehabilitate me. And after the therapy sessions end and they put me to work every day doing the same stuff as before, cleanup details, KP, shoveling snow, and oh, once in a while they're nitpicky, like the time the drill sergeant has me do 2 hours of close order drill by myself on the parade ground because I was out of step marching to breakfast that morning. And there he is, barking commands, about face, to your left, to your right, that kind of stuff. The other prisoners looking on and getting their kicks. But still, it ain't that bad, considering how I'm back at my desk that night. APBA dice rattling, the same group of bored blacks hanging out, listening to my announcing of the game, giving me a hard time, good-naturedly. And finally, one night, the prison warden pays a visit, and I explain honestly that I'm not going to change my mind about rehabilitation, that I'm just as stubborn as the psychiatrists and instructors, and I don't care if I get a bad discharge, and I just want to get out of the military, and it's a waste of time for the military to keep me in after my prison sentence is over. He nods as if in agreement, and in the end that's exactly what happens. I get kicked out with an undesirable discharge, and a new life starts, one in which I become incurably forlorn, as Melville wrote about Bartleby, with whom I form a complete identification years later because my single sentence repetition of "I don't feel I'm mentally or physically capable of killing another human being" to my commanding officer's order to proceed to Nam was, in effect, not unlike Bartleby's "I would prefer not to," and provoked in my commanding officer the same consternation as in Melville's narrator. Bartleby, indeed, the world's ultimate conscientious objector.